Chairman, I move Senate Bill 345 to the floor.
Vice Chairman can't handle those motions. Those numbers are too low. We go to the higher numbers. We will hear 2820 first. Then Markham.
Perfect, Chairman.
Gentlemen, Chairman, for the record, I'm Bill Markham, representing Douglas County, District 46. If I may, I've asked my mouthpiece, if you will, the Oregon Log Truck Association attorney to sit here with me, who understands the technical part of this better than I. 2820, well, I'll read you my two-paragraph pitch here. House Bill 2820 would classify the log trucker who operates and maintains his own equipment as an independent contractor for the purpose of workman's compensation. This bill will finally clarify the status of the log trucker as an independent contractor and not an employee. Court cases have been decided on the individual merits of each situation, leaving the status of the log trucker uncertain. The single log truck operator owns and maintains his own equipment. In fact, he has probably today's value at least $65,000 in a new log truck and trailer, and he's been out of, he's got at least $30,000 in his back shop equipment, so he's in at least the tune of $100,000 and many of them more. The single log truck operator owns and maintains his own equipment. He has the right to select his jobs, and he may hire someone to drive his truck under certain circumstances. Obviously, if he does that, why, he has to place that employee under workman comp. On this basis, the IRS and the National Labor Relations Board have determined the status of the trucker to be an independent contractor. The State Employment Division, according to ORS 657047, also considers the log trucker to be an independent, since the status excludes log truckers from the eligibility of unemployment insurance as self-employed persons. Therefore, the workman's comp law is the only area which refers to log trucker as an employee. The courts have not been able to reach a completely consistent interpretation of the present law, and for this reason, the passage of 2820, in my opinion, is necessary. The distinction of the log trucker as an independent contractor would then be clarified in the statutes without the present necessity of litigating individual cases. We have with us several independent owner log truck people here. I have one sawmill. I have the owner of one sawmill here who also would like to testify on behalf of this bill, and there are several legislators that might like to give it 30 seconds or 1 minute shot a little later. Go ahead, Joe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe French. I'm employed by Oregon Log Truckers Association, and the sole purpose of this bill is to declare the owner-operator log trucker who owns and operates and maintains his own truck to be an independent contractor for the purposes of the workman's compensation law. At the present time, court decisions have ruled that this type of person is an employee for purposes of workman's compensation. And therefore, this would clarify the matter and declare that this person is an independent contractor. Now, there is another provision in the workman's comp law that this type of person, if he's so elected, could cover himself for workman's compensation, but it would not be entirely, but it would legally not be necessary. I want to point out that these persons who are owner-operators do carry medical insurance on themselves, do carry disability policies in case they're injured, They own and maintain and drive their own truck, so they know the vehicle and it is their business. They can't work unlimited amount of hours because the TUC has adopted what we call hours of service, in which they are limited to the number of hours that they can be on duty and the number of hours that they can drive a vehicle in any week. I might point out that, as Representative Markham has stated, in the unemployment compensation statute, we have taken the identical language, and log trucker, owner-operator log truckers cannot draw unemployment compensation because they are not employees. And yet, under workman's compensation law, they are classified as employees. So we think this would be consistent with the present law, because the unemployment compensation law says that employment does not include transportation by motor vehicle of logs, poles, and pilings by any person who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle used in the transportation. And this is the identical language that we are putting, wish to put, in the workman's compensation bill, the law, which says identically the same thing, that they are not employees, but would be independent contractors.
Any objections to that, Bill? I'm reading here on last page, I 31. Any person or person operating as partners of an ownership or leasehold interest in equipment or engaged in business operating such equipment for hire.
I was trying to amend the bill. We have amendments. I think the bill's reduced down to just one section now. It's not the bill as you see it.
From line 31 on, it's
everything is I see. Okay. It's just down to a person who engages in transportation of motor vehicle and logs, poles, and piling, and who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle used in such transportation. Other than the change in the, what is it, a penalty or something?
200, from 100 to 200.
100 to 200, that's the only change in the bill.
What would that do with a partnership?
Senator, partnership would be excluded from the workman's compensation law. At the present time, if you have a valid partnership, you are not required to carry workman's compensation. Now, if a person or if persons wish to become partners, in order to transport logs, poles, and piling, you have to get a certificate from the Public Utilities Commissioner. And to apply and get that certificate would cost you $150. Now, if I wish to take somebody and make them my partner, then I must transfer that certificate, pay another $150 file fee, and then the person I would take in as a partner of myself would also be listed on the TUC directory as a part owner of the certificate. And to the world, he is listed as a partner.
Happened on this bill. We released the bill from the time committee. We think we just had too many bills. And I know that the LSW lumber sawmill workers are opposed to us. And it was dismissed here from my committee yesterday. So I don't know if they've had a chance to down here now, if the people that are opposed to it would have an opportunity to speak in opposition to it, whether you want to give an opportunity to be heard or not, just, of course, it's entirely up to the chairman.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Senator, and I don't want to run over the top of anybody. Do you believe that... I might ask you a question in all fairness. Is there opposition, one of opposed specifically to this bill, or is it opposed to any piece of legislation such as the AFL-CIO might do that relates to workers' compensation? And you're reducing potentially the number of people that might be paying in fund.
No, it's particularly to this bill. And I don't, I really, I have no idea what the reason for opposing it is.
Maybe I make a suggestion. I'd be willing to move the bill and ask the chairman maybe to hold it for a day or so, and then if they want to come down and appear, and I'm trying to move it if we can, not delay it too long. When do we meet again?
I think probably we ought to schedule a meeting tomorrow afternoon, what I think, because we're getting bills faster than we can keep up to them.
Maybe we just hold it off tomorrow afternoon. If they're not here or in any case of the
chairman. Do you know who they are? I mean, I have who to represent.
In the office, I...
Okay, I think in fairness to you, Senator, and
Senator,
well, you raised the fact that
I think you're legal to the
other. We've got okay. You have other comments to make?
Well, if I may, in regards to Senator Groner, I want to assure you it had some real good hearings on the House side. There wasn't any quickie over there. And
was the LSW there?
Yes. In fact, Joe might be able to reiterate their problem with it. I'm trying to remember.
Well, Mr. Cassidy appeared on behalf of the union, and basically his objection, as I remember them, were that this type of person, if he got injured, would probably have no insurance then, and since he's an owner-operator and a small businessman, he might wind up on the welfare rolls and the taxpayers would be supporting him. Secondly, that this type of person would be driving longer hours and perhaps is an unsafer driver than the other true employee who works for a big company because he has to get in extra trips to make the amount of money, and basically I think the rest of his testimony was just opposed to it. I would point out again that this person or any log carrier cannot work unlimited amount of hours because they're restricted by the hours of service. The same as an over-the-road freight carrier on the Well, in answer to your question, Senator, I guess anyone could do that, but I think that this type of person, first of all, the PUC does audit hours of service, and you have to keep a log or a record of the hours that you are on duty and the hours that you drive, and I'm sure that it's possible to fudge on it. My understanding from, I think most people try to comply with it because it's $100 violation or fine potential for any violation of this particular rule. And furthermore, I think that the owner-operator or anybody else sets his pay scale or his rate that he's going to charge based on a certain hours in a day, and if he's going to work longer hours, he's going to be making less, the same amount of money, and I don't think most of them can do that.
Okay. Representative Markham, you can share with me the dilemma. I've got several bills I've got to look at, and I can spend all morning on this bill. Now, what are we going to do with it? Do you have any suggestions?
Why don't you all go? Why don't we notify tomorrow and get it to be here tomorrow?
Okay, let me ask the witnesses to come here. I understand that. We've got witnesses from Washington County, I see Clark County, and Representative Al Shaw is here from District 45, and then the other company, where they're from.
Representative Rogers is here.
He's here also.
I have people here from Douglas County in the milling, sawmilling business.
Okay. You understand my dilemma now. How many people have heard, you've heard what was said. How many have got something additional to what was said? Let's just start down with the list. First of all, Representative Rogers, Representative Shaw, I hope you understand the dilemma. I've got several bills we've got to work on, and if I went through this list, it'd be here until 10 o'clock, and everyone would give their testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one of those other bills here that I'm here for this morning. One thing I'd like to point out is we did have extensive testimony in the House Labor Committee on which I serve, and I'm going through my notes. There, Chuck Gill had this to say: when the law was passed in 1965, these folks were considered as employees. And then in court cases, it was decided that they were subject workmen, and he supports the exemption owner-operator, as that is to say. Now, let me give you quickly, I've got a son-in-law. He and his father are partners in a log trucking operation over Toledo. They have one employee. So the three of them drive, and they don't have to have workman's comp because they have that one employee. If they did not have an employee, then they would be caught up in this web. And so that's the weird way this thing operates. It's just a real inequity for people who have that kind of an investment. Their store happens to be on wheels, rather than at a fixed location. And that's all that I would have to add.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Al Shaw, State Representative, District 45. I'm not going to repeat a lot of this. All I want to say is I'm in support of the bill. We went through a lot of hearings in the Transportation Committee on the House side that didn't necessarily relate to this bill, but in similar circumstances in the log truckers and being between a rock and a hard place most of the time. I understand this problem and I'm very much in favor of this bill that we can do something there and help them and stay away from the mandated insurance.
Yes. You heard this bill in your committee?
Yes.
Was the testimony pretty much as lumber and sawmill workers pretty much as indicated as anyone
That was almost precisely what was said.
And that's the bill as it sits right now, not with
that's
all the other
correct.
Stuff on
mm-hmm.
Senator Whitfield? Mr. Carroll, who has just been assigned to this committee, who is the administrator of the House
Transportation
Committee. House Transportation
Committee. This was in the House Labor Committee.
Oh, it was in the Labor
Committee.
Right. He's going to be working, Mr. Carroll's going to be working with us on our transportation bills, right? Okay, let's move on to Mr. Zumwalt.
Wright County. I'm Dale Zumwalt, and I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon. I'd just like to make one comment and make it quick about the question about working too long. There's no possible way that you could work too long because dump hours are only open at the very earliest at 7 o'clock and they close at 5. So you got to get your work done in between that time. So there's really no possible way to fudge on your hours.
The most you do is conceivably do would be to have a load ready in the morning by 7 o'clock.
Right.
And even if you had one at night, you couldn't get it unloaded, so you'd have to wait until the next morning.
Right. So it's really hard to fudge on that.
Okay. One other question.
Do you have insurance?
Yes.
Most all the folks you know, cover themselves with medical insurance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'd have.
You won't be cast off on the welfare rolls of the state of Oregon.
I would hope not.
Oh, working guy, you take care of it.
Sure would.
Wouldn't we?
You sure would. Thank you then, Mr. Segner? Okay, I appreciate that. I think the committee has heard enough of controversies. You know, this is not the only bill in this area. I think we understand the issues. We want to give the other side in fairness an opportunity, and I appreciate your helping us. Mr. Bateman, you are self-employed. Where do you operate, sir? Okay. You operate your own vehicle, apparently. I do. Larry, and you're going to help me with your last name. Risa? You're from what area? And you have your own truck? Mary Jane June Spencer. You operate your own truck too? I see. Okay. So that's where I start learning. Marlon Cox, I believe.
Marlon in the space of brevity, he and his wife get up west, but he operates about a sawmill and logging outfit down in my area, employs about 175 people. He's the one that came to me along with a couple of truckers that he employed suggesting this bill. I saw I didn't hold it here, in fact, he wanted.
When Mr. Gill made his comments before the House Labor Committee, did you recall any figure, dollar amount that this was going to affect the fund?
Well, there's not a dollar amount, Archie. It's 700 independent logs.
And are they currently? They're not paying currently workers' comp, but the question is whether they should pay it. That's where
they are paying.
They're being forced
into this bill of what? $300 to $400 a month now, aren't you, on the workers' comp? Any of them can buy similar, not quite as comprehensive coverage, about half that price for 24-hour coverage. But the big thing here is that they're being treated differently than other people going their own business.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your cooperation, and we'll certainly give the bill fair consideration tomorrow when the other side.
Thank
you. We meet at 1:30 tomorrow. Okay, let's go to the next, Representative Starr, is there any other legislator in the room that I've overlooked that here? Background on what brings
House Bill 3166 before you, so you can clearly understand the need for it. In 1975, this legislature passed a law in response to concern of citizens and public officials and legislators about the tragic accidents, the tragic consequences that can follow railroad accidents involving the transportation of hazardous materials. And this was prompted by some events that occurred that where whole areas were devastated by explosions in railroad yards. You might possibly remember the Roseville catastrophe and the one at Wenatchee. There was another we're talking about something different. Roseburg, I'm talking about Roseville. Did I say Roseburg?
Well, maybe I'm
awfully sorry. It's Roseville, California. And so the concern over these things brought about the passage of this bill in the last legislature that would, among other things, require that these hazardous commodities, when they weren't actually moving, would be stored in what would be defined as minimum risk areas, which would be isolated from inhabited buildings and from bridges and from power lines and from dams and from rivers and from locks or from anything that could really hamper commerce and industry and that if an explosion occurred. Other types of commodities are contaminants that can harm water supplies, that can contaminate the air and cause evacuation of communities, which has occurred in different parts of the country. So part of this bill that was passed required rulemaking on the part of the Public Utilities Commissioner in order to make this law work. In the process of promulgating these rules, it just became apparent that it was extremely difficult and if not impossible to define and provide and make workable these minimum risk areas. Because of the restrictions that would have to be on them. And it turned out that in Oregon there were very few places that it could be done, and if it were done, it would probably impose a burden on the commerce that would be just difficult to make it work, and we couldn't see where it would do a lot of good. So that's what the major change in the law that's brought about by House Bill 3166. It removes from the present law, present statute, any reference to minimum risk area. It preserves the other things that were in the law, which required advance notice by railroads when they're about to transport these commodities through the state. The purpose of this is so that the Public Utility Commissioner, the State Fire Marshal, the Emergency Services, in the Executive Department would know when these commodities were being transported. So in the event, and only in the event of a serious accident of some kind, they would be alerted, they would know what they had to deal with, and could get the forces out there to deal with it. If it was a fire, they would know in advance what would be the thing to do used to put it out and not make it worse. If it were contaminated air, well, they'd know, have some idea that must this community be evacuated until we get it cleared up, or need it not be, and that type of thing. So that is the bill we have before you. Section 2 clarifies some of the language that is in the law. It doesn't change it at all, except to make it more clear as to what kind of notice and when it would be given. The deleted language in lines 28 to 32, where that was deleted because it's already done and it's required by federal law, and the notification of the crew is taken care of, so it isn't necessary to be in the Oregon law. In section 5 and 6 of the bill, it's a new language that's been added to the law, and it provides some extra care. It provides there that any time the railroad is required under federal law to give notice to the U.S. Department of Transportation of an incident involving a transportation commodity, that is also notify the administrator of the Emergency Services Division in the state. And then, as soon as possible after, in the event some incident occurred, that the communication would be made when there's a derailment or a fire involving this commodity. Some additional language in here will require that the railroads provide communication by two-way radio among the crew members, so that when there is an accident, the crew members are out on the ground. They have no way of communicating in some cases with other members of the crew and with the railroad chief dispatcher. By equipping all these trains with these radios for the use of the crew, this communication would be vastly improved. It really isn't that bad right now. Most of them have this already, but some don't. And this would make sure that that would take place. In section 6, this is simply a requirement that when certain cars containing hazardous materials are set out, some trains are stored in place, that within 2 hours after that occurred, that there would be an external inspection of the car to make sure it was okay, and then the same thing would occur within 2 hours before it was moved again, and that's to take precaution in case of any vandalism or any leakage that might occur in the car that would cause it to be unsafe for transportation. Now, these amendments to the present law have been worked out very carefully before it even went to a hearing in the House Committee. So there's some pretty agreement with the railroad, with the railroad labor organization, with the public utility commissioners, with the legislators that were involved, and with the Emergency Services Division. And it's a good bill to so we can get going on these commissioners' rules in order to make all this work. There's some amendments that we've agreed upon to the proposed commissioners' rules that would be in line with the advancements here. And it's a great bill for railroad safety and for safety of the public, and I urge the committee to look very favorably on it.
I noticed by the sign-up sheet that Mr. Miller from the Oregon Railroad Association obviously supporting it, apparently, the bills at their request, and I mean, you, to you, in addition to your testimony, I'm supporting the bill now. What happened in the House as far as the flow of witnesses? Was there other people interested in the bill?
What happened in the House is what I just said. We had some adversary positions on this thing, and we brought all these things together. Okay. We didn't disturb the House Committee or anybody with it. We did it among ourselves and came up with a complete agreement, and I'm sure they'll probably.
There's a question, yes, Senator Brown.
One thing on materials, like Commissioner Gage at the gate, and how much of this?
There's, the rules aren't
the representative of the Texas office here, I believe. Didn't I not see Frank Gillow?
Okay.
There he is.
Okay.
Would you like to have
that? Probably better than I have. listing prepared by the U.S. Department of Transportation, which breaks out all the whole variety of different kinds of materials. The hazardous one is, George over here on a long list. Why don't you run through them, George?
Well, it says the original one.
Yes, I'm at the time,
the sudden file legislation, and all of mutual discomfort and impasse over continuing to serve the state with its commentary service under the rules that were dictated or in law. So we have the bill produced by Representative Grinnell, because Representative Grinnell sponsored the legislation 2 years ago. He was the one that in 1973 started the idea of something like this. The 75 law, he was brief enough to recognize the work about it, and this the bill was going to hand in on it. And so it's been that kind of thing. It's been developed very carefully to try to get a maximum amount of precaution, still saving our customers and reassuring people that have some safe concerns. Representative Whiting, you remember, who was chairman of the Transportation Committee in the House this year, was one of the supporters of the bill in 75 and testified in favor of it. These people all have been on the negotiation which has led to this point. And of course, Senator Representative Starr, being on the committee, understands exactly the situation that developed and has been saying a lot of times. So I just want to give you that background. There are two major changes in the law. The minimum risk area concept, which is just impossible either to define or to implement, has been taken out. The other thing is an advance notice of 8 hours, which, again, is railroads operate across the state of Oregon. It's impossible to know what cars are in what train 8 hours ahead. The reporting requirements and the new amendments, including the radio, which is an immediate access to an incident, which might later create a hazard. As Representative Starr, that covers the notification through the emergency services. And we really kind of feel it's the best we can do, isn't that right? There's some things you just cannot, without stopping the trains at the state line, get past. But this bill, we again, it does, and that's all.
But I'm still not convinced of the need for the language. The new language on line 17 and the new language on line 18 up through and including or. What damage would be done to the bill if it just hazardous material are added to the train while in wait? Notification shall be given as soon as information is available. What kind of hazardous material originates in Oregon that would be transported?
Ammonia? I think that's
ammonia.
None of this is known in advance that it's being loaded and it's going to be transported. I would say that is sort of a significant, that's potentially a significant loophole.
It's not intended as a loophole, I'm sure, but I think a lot of it has to do with the way the cars in the yard may be assembled from different things and end up in another, and this matter of...
Is it a fair assumption, Senator Whipple might help here, they mentioned ammonia. We probably, at least maybe I'm being a little bit presumptuous here, but I would assume that what you're driving at is the question of nuclear waste. That's the first thing that would come up, and we're trying to figure out where in Oregon that's going to come from. I suppose they're coming from the side that there are some things that to them and to the PUC and to people that regulate are hazardous waste or hazardous material, which to us, we just live with and we assume that they're not, and I think they're trying to give latitude for the switching that takes place in the yard or the adding or tracking cars from a train, and maybe someone's moving from point A to B and they're required to stop in between and pick up something that conceivably to an average citizen is not hazardous yet.
I don't.
If that's what we're trying to get at, rather.
Well, the switching is specifically excluded.
Yeah. Switching, okay. Didn't you comment, Mr. Miller, something about trains assembling in a yard? I don't have the terminology correct, but then switching and adding and suppressing.
This acknowledges just the way the records are kept, the manifest that comes through on a train when it's put together, and of course the conductor on the train has a list of all the cars with the commodities that are in it. But a train moving from Southern California across Oregon might pick up material within the state, and it's on computer, or train thing too. But there are circumstances where you wouldn't be able to specifically comply, even remember the rails are the first ones to want to safeguard the shipment. So it isn't an effort to have a loophole, it's just recognize the practical.
Well, that's my question. I have no problem that if hazardous materials are added in route, notification will be given as soon as information is available. You haven't really addressed to my satisfaction yet why we have to have language. If the information necessary for the notification is not available before beginning the train movement, it seems to me that information would be available. You would know at the time that train left what was on it.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
We're invaded this possible situation. The train is moving from, you see, this requires that this advance notification be given even include when the train enters the state, not when it starts from some terminal within the state. It includes both, see? So that we're invading the situation.
So if I'm moving toward the shipment, we would have known it by then. If it had been going across another state, shipment would be aware by the time it enters the state.
And the situation is that sometimes between maybe a point where a train originates out of the state and the time it enters the state, it could entrain some of these commodities, and this information may not be available the very moment that train crosses the state line. And that's one of the things we're trying to get at, that it would not put the railroads in a bind where they're in a violation where they didn't have the information that.
That language says that hazardous material are added to the road train while en route. I can understand that. What I have difficulty with understanding is that you not know at the beginning of the shipment if you have hazardous material on there. So, of course, I don't know the technical details of how you put trains together. It would seem to me, though, if you were dealing with hazardous material at the time that train left its departure point, you would be aware.
Kind of what you're dealing with a really technical situation of this language and part of conversations on these names have been taken up with the Federal Railroad Administration people who are experts in this field. If I can get an answer to you why that specific language is there, I believe it would satisfy you. I believe that's a tool language and it's not intended, as I say, as a loophole. It's an effort to get away from what we have now, and that's an unworkable thing into some language that will, if not right, permit the movement, permit the keeping the records and the reporting and so on, and I'm very reluctant to disturb the language of it at this point, if we can avoid it. I would rather see if I can get an answer for you that would say,
when you confer with your people, would you ask them if we remove that language, if that would bother. I frankly can't see how it would.
I guess the reason we're kind of uptight about the language is that we have had countless meetings. We've shaken hands over one version, somebody found something wrong, and we've met again, and everybody, including the sponsors of the bill, are the inside. So we're kind of reluctant to undo it now without betraying some of the people that have been in on it. But I will get you in touch with someone.
Miller, can you make contact with people by tomorrow?
Yes, as soon as I can get them in touch with you.
Would that be agreeable? We'll pick up at 1:30 tomorrow, so we'll have. Are there other comments?
I can assure you that when I go back to work on the train, and this law becomes effective and that language is in there,
that the person any other time that I see that being violated, well, the whole United States will know about it. We were concerned about it, and we thought that was the most ideal language we could put in to take care of every situation.
Mr. Beaver. Private business people, they aren't required. people, and they see no reason why they should be covered when other self-employed people aren't required to be covered. I think that's the issue at hand. Maybe you could address that point, if you would please.
Well, the log truck driver who purchases his own truck, and which is an investment of anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000 and more, doesn't know the fact that in most instances he drives a truck, which makes him no different than any other truck driver, except that he owns his own truck, and I'm not trying to be critical of the fact that a man wants to make that investment for the obvious reason he's going to make more money, and whatever other motives you may have. But it still doesn't change the fact that he's the one behind the wheel of that truck, bearing in mind that workman's compensation is a law designed to protect, not to injure, the worker. And in this particular instance, as is indicated by the $32 rate, logging is the most hazardous industry in our state, even more hazardous, as indicated by the rate at least, than mining. So, the fact that this man has bought his own truck doesn't mean that the work he's doing is less hazardous than it was before he bought the truck. And in almost all instances, well, I won't say all, in many instances, he doesn't hire someone to drive that truck, he drives it himself. Now, I see no reason that the funds should be diluted by allowing 700 approximately of approximately 5,000 log truck drivers in the state of Oregon released from the responsibility of protecting themselves and incidentally the public, since these trucks are driven up and down the freeways and over public roads. If they have an accident, which they're going to have, the fact that they own their own truck is maybe going to have less accidents. In my opinion, it means they're going to have more accidents. Because a man who makes that kind of an investment will operate that equipment just as long and as often as he can. Even though there are laws in the state prohibiting the number of hours that you can have that truck on the road, he operated right up to the maximum of that, and in deference to any of those gentlemen that may be here, they would see it too. And it is an instance. I think that I sincerely believe that the longer that truck's on the road, the more hazardous it becomes because of the fatigue factor. Now, since passing this law or not passing will have no effect whatsoever on the hazards that those truck drivers are going to be engaging in, and it isn't going to prevent or cause any more accidents, I just can't believe that a committee of the Oregon State Senate would submit the public to the danger of those accidents involving people other than their truck drivers. And not giving us some protection.
Isn't the thrust of the workers' compensation law going to protect the employee and limit for that protection, the employer limits his liability. It's built upon two elements. And you speak to protect the driver. The driver also, in this case, there's no one that's conceivably no employee that can bring suit because he owns the truck, he drives the truck. I guess I was just thinking of the thrust of the workers' compensation statute. It's a two-way, there's two elements that it's built upon.
That's very true, but then the assumption of the law in that respect involving the fact that it's generally, almost always, an employer with anywhere from a few to a great many employees. And he doesn't engage in operating the equipment. In this instance, the owner is the operator of the equipment. And therefore, is not only in need, but is deserving, to believe, of the protection that the law allows on him.
He's able to get other insurance.
But he won't. Can you picture the guy trucker man who has made a tremendous investment and said, well, I've never had an accident, I'm not going to have an accident, and I'm only saving money, so the heck with the insurance. There won't be a great many of them, and the rest of them are just as responsible as can be, but there are a few that don't.
Mr.
Chairman, I trust that I don't know. You mean that the present law, if the independent contract would be exempt from workman's compensation at this time, are there contested cases, or where is the workman's compensation bill or the court rules on this problem?
I don't think there's rules. I'm not sure, sir.
It's happening now. I mean, do the independent truck drivers carry workman's compensation?
They're required.
They are required to? As I understand, there are still those that are not carrying it, though.
Increase wages and
are required to be negotiated with them, and if you would not like to see the same demand,